Hello, and welcome to DebtWired Podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Saba, senior reporter of DebtWire North America. I'm glad to be joined today by Bob DelGenio, turnaround specialist at FTI Consulting, a restructuring advisory firm that has been among the top ranked in terms of number of North American mandates for some consumer-branded products special situations. Where City Brewing, he represented the company in its Avocourt restructuring process and other cases as well, such as Next Level Apparel. When he's not reading historical novels like Undaunted Courage by Stephen Ambrose and traveling with his family to Rome and the Tuscany region of central Italy, he is providing financial advisory solutions to consumer company leaders and their lenders. With a 30 plus year track record of fixing companies across multiple industries, including consumer products, what do you think it takes to have a long lasting career in restructuring?
Well, one of the things in restructuring you have to do is when you get involved in a situation is get up to speed very quickly on imperfect information. I always say that being a restructuring advisor is like a sponge. You go in and learn as much as you can quickly. Then you have to look at what are the key issues that are affecting the company. Is it an industry problem, regulatory, operational issues? Maybe there's management turnover, or it's a good company, bad capital structure. The other thing I think is really important in the process is to be available for your clients, because restructuring situations, companies are having a lot of issues. They want to know the advisors involved and they can reach them at any time and you'll be responsive. Communication is always important with your team as well as the other professionals you're working with, if say you're representing a company, so that you're giving a consistent message to stakeholders, because that's very important. Another thing that I pride myself on is staying calm in a restructuring environment, because there's a lot of emotion there. Staying calm, thinking clearly. And lastly, which is critically important, your word is your bond. And if you tell somebody you're going to do something, you have to be able to deliver it.
How did you get into the business of helping companies? What led you here?
After I got out of business school, I worked with Ernst & Young, or EY, and I was in a M&A group. And then I was doing middle market M&A. And then the person that hired me got transferred to New York. So after he went to New York, he had a couple of projects that fell behind. He would fly me up. I'd work for like 2 weeks straight, get the project back in place, and then go back to Ohio. While I was up there, I met Art Newman. And Art Newman at that time was at Ernst & Young. He founded the restructuring group at Blackstone. So he was building the corporate finance and restructuring group in New York. He asked me to transfer to New York. One of the reasons that he was interested in having me work there as he saw the nature of restructurings becoming more transactional oriented, and he wanted me to work on distressed transactions besides healthy ones with the restructuring team. Well, as you know, the restructuring and M&A market are kind of counter-cyclical. So when the M&A market was a little bit slower, they asked me to start leading restructuring assignments. I liked that, and I ended up in the business.
Fast forward to 2026, what do you think consumer product companies are most concerned about today?
Right now, the big concern is inflation. If you think about food and beverage companies, they're faced with inflation from commodities and other consumer products companies, rising inputs and also tariffs. And then that's into an environment where last year, year before, a lot of manufacturers, they were basically absorbing some of the tariffs and also asking their suppliers to absorb some. But coming into this year, 2026, the question is, how long can they do that? How long can they continue? And you see in the earnings release and that a lot of conversation about that, because the consumer, the ultimate customer, is inflation weary and also worried about the job market. Although the January numbers were pretty good, that was only 1 month. With that as a backdrop, they're looking at ways to position their product in that environment, redesigning their supply chain, looking at ways to take costs out of products, changing packaging sizes, and different types of innovation to deal with this environment that they're selling into right now.
I did notice the packages are getting smaller. Is that a cost savings, or is that just where the consumer market is, in terms of people's appetites decreasing?
There's two things, and that really kind of goes to GLP, which we can talk about. But I think initially, it's a way to keep a price point in a place where it's more affordable. So it might be a smaller package, you get less, but it's also more affordable. And you can see That's with packaged goods. You could see that in sodas, like in terms of the size of the cans and those types of issues. And that's their way of trying to put out a product that they can still hold on to their consumer.
Interesting. So in terms of sourcing, it's been a topic of discussion. Where do you think consumer product companies have shifted their sourcing of goods from in your experience for those that are heavily reliant on China or were?
It really depends on the industry and the product, but let's take apparel. First of all, we saw companies starting to challenge their supply chains in the first Trump administration, and then that was accelerated because of concern of tariffs, and that was accelerated once tariffs came in place. So we saw companies that traditionally got everything out of China were now getting products from Vietnam, Malaysia, India, for example, other places in Asia. What's interesting is a lot of those companies are still controlled by Chinese companies, but the manufacturing is done in the countries that I just mentioned. For higher end goods, luxury goods, there's been some movement to Eastern Europe, as opposed to maybe the traditional companies. Some of them are countries they would have been manufactured, like Italy or France or a place like that. You also saw a movement to, and you're seeing now, nearshoring, Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. And the apparel companies had operations or suppliers in those regions, but they're shifting more product to that, assuming that those suppliers are able to make the product they're looking for. And then I've read something recently interesting in apparel that there was some manufacturing that was actually being done in Los Angeles because there is an apparel industry in Los Angeles and some more product was shifted there. It also depends on the price point of that product. You think about technology products, consumer products, China is still going to be a very big player. China and Taiwan have tremendous manufacturing expertise in that. Companies that are looking at US and Europe and other parts of Asia are still, they're looking to move business there, but China still and Taiwan is still going to be very, very important to the technology manufacturing supply chain.
And branded food and beverage companies, they've come under pressure, as we talked about, appealing to the healthier alternatives. How has this impacted some of the larger players?
The GLPs, ones are a big topic right now. FTI just conducted, some of my colleagues, a survey on that, looking at basically purchasing information at retail and restaurants, as well as grocery, just trends that are going on. And what they've noticed, like on the grocery side, center aisle and snacking, consumption or purchasing is down. It's also affected other products like frozen foods, chocolate, soda. So you're seeing companies now trying to figure out how to best position their products in that environment. Just today in the Wall Street Journal, you saw a number of earnings announcements and companies, CPG, restaurant companies, talking about their products and the amount of protein and fiber in their products, or that their menu is protein rich. That's really to sell to that GLP customer. Then just non-GLP customers right now are looking for more healthier products, looking at products where, like, when you read the label, you understand everything on the label and not lots of chemicals. Also environmentally friendly packaging. And then the consumer products companies are spending a lot of time trying to figure out for that customer, what medians do they use to educate themselves? So then when they're talking about the product, is that on YouTube or is it on a podcast, or what's influencing them when they're making purchasing decisions?
Interesting. So what's your outlook for CPGs in terms of LME or restructurings? I mean, last year we saw Del Monte file. What types of food and beverage companies are you watching?
We can talk about LMEs because that's a whole separate topic. But in terms of companies that we're watching, alcohol-related businesses, because whether it's manufacturer or distributors, because alcohol consumption is down. I mean, there was just an announcement yesterday that Heineken laid off 6,000 employees because their volume is down. Snack-related businesses are some things we just talked about in terms of the health and what people are looking at. Affecting consumer products, chain-related restaurants and their franchisees, and how are they positioned with this type of consumer we just talked about. Outsource manufacturing for food and beverage. If volumes are down and you have both your own manufacturing plants and then you have contract manufacturers, the natural tendency is to move some of that product back in your plants so you're keeping them fully utilized, and that affects some of the contract manufacturers. The other thing that's very interesting about consumer products is a lot of companies are still facing what I call the COVID bump. They scaled up for volumes on COVID. Probably the best example are health and fitness companies. And there was a lot of purchasing when people were in their homes, apartments, and that. And then the level of volumes back to what I would call a more normal level. And then they have to think about retooling their supply chain, looking at their workforce. Do they have too many people for the type of volume that they have now? So we've seen a lot of that. Companies that, even though COVID was a while ago, still working through that COVID bump because they realize the volumes aren't as high as they were during that period.
I mean, shifting back to LMEs, there aren't a lot of them in retail. Can you say the same about consumer products?
There have been LMEs in consumer products. So what I like to do is think about, why do LMEs exist and what's driving that? So if we look at last year, the capital markets were very active. You saw the banks come back and very aggressively in lending in the market. You had an active high yield market and a very active private credit market. With that level of competition, what happens is companies and sponsors, because they know that there's different financing sources competing for their business, start to look for looser documents to give them some more flexibility. They push back on pricing. It is a borrower-friendly market. So if you have a borrower-friendly market, you have looser documents which allow you to employ LME strategies, and a company that's over-levered, that creates an environment where you'll see more liability management transactions. Now, there's a lot of good things with liability management transactions because you give the company an ability or time to fix themselves. If you're in a cyclical business, maybe commodity cycle, like if you look at chocolate spikes and then it comes back down to normal, maybe that period you get a little bit of breathing room. However, LMEs, if you're just fixing the balance sheet and you're not fixing a company, then that's not a good thing.
This year's big liability management exercise trend was the tiered exchanges, especially post-CERTA. Some of these non-pro rata exchanges proved to be painful for investors who ended up having to take large discounts. Do you expect them to continue?
Yes, with more borrower-friendly credit agreements and leveraged companies, we do think that can continue to be LME transactions. And the market's continuing to evolve post-CERTA. Up-tiering is clearly the more preferred LME, but we're still seeing drop-downs. One of the lessons learned from CERTA, MITEL, and TPC is courts are very reluctant to rule unless language is very specific. So you'll see a lot of finance lawyers now working with companies or sponsors really working on very specific language. Some of the things we're seeing in documents are allowing buybacks through privately negotiated transactions on a non-pro rata basis and omitting the mention of open market purchases in response to the Fifth Circuit ruling. LMEs have become more consensual, where effectively it's available for all parties. However, that doesn't mean that you can have different economics or changes. For example, an ad hoc group with a steering committee, they might get a backstop fee, so they get additional economics that the rest of the participants in a LME would not receive. Also, they might have a higher exchange price than someone else that participates. And if you don't participate at all, there might be even a lower exchange price. So that's still going on. Now, credit investors are trying to protect themselves. So they're putting in what's referred to as LME blockers. And what's very interesting is when you read the documents, the LME blockers are named by LME transactions that they're trying to prohibit. J. Crew blocker, CERTA blocker, Chewy blocker, you see a whole list of those using that language within the document. One of the things that's been interesting is, you know, Wall Street always innovates. So to deal with the Fifth Circuit ruling, there's been some new structures, an extend and exchange, where effectively you take a maturity of a loan, you extend it into a specific class. A lot of times you'll need majority of lenders to do that. And then that extended loan gets exchanged into a priming piece. That's kind of a workaround to the Fifth Circuit CERTA ruling. Also, you see accordion features. A lot of loans have an accordion where you can do additional financing. You fund into the accordion feature, and then those that participate would then convert that into a priming security. So there's a lot of innovation that's going on, and that's what I think very smart financial advisors, bankers, and lawyers work on to figure out, have a ruling, but is there alternatives within the documents to come up with a different structure? That's capitalism.
Thank you. Bob, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thanks for taking the time to share your valuable insights.
Thank you very much.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of DebtWired. As always, you can subscribe or download every episode via Apple and find dozens of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at DebtWired.com.